This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is marine biologist Sarika Kullis-Suzuki. Sarika holds a Master of Science in Zoology from the University of British Columbia Fisheries Center and is currently studying for a PhD in marine biology at the University of York in England. She has co-hosted several TV programs, including the CBC's Suzuki Diaries 11 on oceans. Sarika Kullis-Suzuki is here today to speak about ocean conservation and the book for which she wrote the introduction, Beneath Cold Seas, The Underwater Wilderness of the Pacific Northwest, authored by award-winning photographer David Hall and published in 2011. Welcome, Sarika.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to begin by giving a brief overview of the book, Beneath Cold Seas?
Well, this is a project that was very different from what I normally do. I was first approached by David Hall to be part of this book, and I just wrote the introduction, but it's really kind of the brainchild of David Hall. He took the photographs, he wrote most of the book, and it's really about the stunning images that he has captured all up and down the Pacific Northwest. And what he's done, well, he's from New York City, and he came over to the Pacific Northwest. And it took him 15 years to get all these images for the book. So it really was a real devotion for him. And as a result, you know, he takes painstakingly, meticulously beautiful photographs, and he has an incredible book. And it's really a visual feast for anybody who wants to flip through.
What drew you personally to marine biology and ocean protection?
Well, I've grown up by the ocean my entire life. I was born into a family of environmentalists and activists. And through my lifetime, I was born in Vancouver, and I also went up to our family cabin on Quadra Island, which is in the Strait of Georgia in British Columbia. And when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time on the beaches, flipping over rocks and fishing, a lot of time fishing. And I watched as the oceans changed during my lifetime. And I went to do marine biology as an undergraduate, and I was really drawn to marine biology because of the splendor and the wonder of the oceans. And when I went into fishery science for my master's, it was then that I was really faced with all the threats. It was the first time that I really learned about all the threats that were facing the ocean. And after that, I mean, I really felt that you couldn't study biology without also inherently studying marine conservation. So once you know about all these problems, you kind of have to do something about them. So I continued on, and that's kind of really my focus now for my PhD.
Would you remind us of the importance of the ocean for humans?
It's kind of a loaded question because we completely depend on oceans for our survival. We came from the oceans. We eat food that comes from the oceans. We breathe air that comes from the sea. And so everything that we do is absolutely interconnected. And there's a beautiful story that I like to tell about salmon forests on the West Coast. We always thought that salmon fed surrounding animals like whales and sea lions and animals in the ocean. But about 10 years ago, a team of scientists from the University of Victoria in British Columbia did this amazing study where they showed that certain elements that are found in salmon are also found in trees that surround the streams. And the mechanism behind it is salmon will leave their natal streams, go out to the ocean, return to the very same streams where they were born, and they spawn and die. And then bears come out of the forest, take their bodies, bring them back into the forest, eat them, but they don't eat the whole thing, so the rest of the salmon will decompose, and those nutrients from the salmon will actually be absorbed into the shrubs and the trees and the mosses that surround the banks. So this just shows how interconnected everything is, and all these ecosystems, terrestrial, ocean, ourselves, you know, there really is no separation, and what we do to the oceans, we're really doing to ourselves.
What are some examples from the book of the marine life in the Pacific Northwest? Would you go into detail?
Yeah, there are a lot of examples in this book. They talk about salmon. There are some spectacular images that David took. He took them last year, 2010, during the record run of the sockeye coming back to the Fraser River. And I mean, we were just talking about this before we started, but they are phenomenal photographs. There's one image in particular that sticks out in my mind. It basically looks like a wall of salmon. They're just staring you in the face. And this was because last year there was 34 million sockeye returning to the Fraser, and it was just chock full. But the year before that, of course, we had a real low year. There was only 10% of the predicted runs came back. And because of this, our Prime Minister in Canada, Stephen Harper, called a federal inquiry into the disappearance of sockeye. So this is contrasted to the disappearance of sockeye the year before, but David has been able to capture a real abundant year. But he has all different types of species. He has rockfish as well, and there are some spectacular images of rockfish schooling, black rockfish. And I didn't even know that rockfish schooled because I'd never seen them in such abundance before. So really, David has been able to go into areas along the Pacific Northwest that are still very abundant and captured these photographs for us.
Would you comment on the overall biodiversity found off the Pacific coast of North America?
Yeah, well, we are very fortunate. We have a long and varied coastline here. And generally, when people talk about the Pacific Northwest, marine biologists refer to it as the area encompassing or between Northern California all the way up to Alaska. And it's very diverse. I mean, we have sandy beaches, sheltered coves, howling channels. We have a big diversity of habitat as well, from kelp forests to eelgrass beds to rocky areas, and a lot of nutrients and upwelling that come from the various currents. And it's characterized by a very cool water ecosystem. So compared to the rest of the world, I would say that it's very rich and abundant. But if we were to compare it to what it used to be, say 100, 200 years ago, it's not as abundant as it used to be. And I think having baselines and being able to refer back and remember what used to be is absolutely integral when we talk about marine conservation in the future.
How well documented are the species in the marine ecosystems of the Northwest?
Well, I think that they are documented. I don't think that we know nearly as much as we should, or in the next decade or so, I think we are going to learn a lot more. I read that every week, a couple fish species alone are found in the oceans. And this is just striking. I mean, that just goes to show how much we don't yet know. But there are initiatives that are going on up and down the coast. There is the Venus and Neptune things, where they have basically it's an underwater cabled observatory. And we're now able to see in real time what is happening under the waves on our coasts. So there's a lot of research going into this stuff right now. I think up until now, we don't really know that much about species that are not commercially extracted. So meaning not the species that we are normally eating. There are other animals, for instance, the species that I'm studying right now for my PhD, I knew nothing about it. And I'm finding that it's popping up everywhere on the coast. So I think once we start asking these questions and looking a little deeper, we'll find a lot more.
You mentioned that there are fewer species now than a while back. How healthy, though, overall are the marine ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, again, I would say that relatively we're doing okay, but the baseline that we need to be gauging ourselves against is our own coasts and what they historically were. And a couple years ago, I was at the BBC Natural History Unit in Bristol in the UK. And I was sitting down having lunch, and one of the producers sat down next to me and we started talking, and he was completely uninterested in what I was saying until he found out where I was from. And he immediately, I mean, his eyes just popped open and he started peppering me with questions because he was so excited that I was from the Pacific Northwest. And he asked me questions like, is it true that you have some of the world's largest salmon returns and runs? And is it true that you have grizzly bears and black bears and eagles and herring? And it just went on and on and on. And by the end of our conversation, I was so excited. And the reason he was asking was because he wanted to do a show on the wealth and abundance of our coastal ecosystems. And it made me very proud to know that that's what we still had, and kind of funny that it took somebody from outside of Canada to remind me of what we still had. But it also made me sad because I realized that the waters surrounding the UK at one time were very rich and abundant as well. And we forget that, you know. And so for him, he had to go all the way to North America to witness and film something like that. But a couple hundred years ago, it would have been similar around his coasts.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is marine biologist Sarika Kalasuzuki. Our topic is ocean conservation and the book, Beneath Cold Seas, The Underwater Wilderness of the Pacific Northwest. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the key threats to marine ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I think we have to zoom out for a second and look at what the threats are that are facing our global oceans and that are also inherently facing our coasts as well. So if you think of things like climate change, the rising ocean temperatures, and ocean acidification, as well as marine pollution, we now have garbage patches in all five of our great ocean systems. We have dead zones that are cropping up. There's actually a big one off the Oregon on the west coast here. And overfishing is massive. I mean, we have overfished 90% of our biggest ocean predators and fish are now gone. And scientists are saying that by mid-century, all our commercial fish stocks could also vanish. So these are kind of scary times. On the West Coast, when we talk about our iconic fish species, like salmon and halibut and rockfish, if we look at what the runs used to be, we are at a very diminished rate. And as I mentioned before, in Canada, we have sockeye salmon, and that's kind of our real iconic species. And 2 years ago, we had to have a federal inquiry into the disappearance of sockeye because they came back in such low numbers. So there are lots of things that are affecting our coasts right now. And the problem and also the advantage is we have a real diversity of species. So when one species is fished out, we are still able to shift to another. We talk about halibut as being a sustainable option, but actually this year, the Pacific Salmon Commission, which is made up of the US and the Canadian governments, has suggested to both our countries that we decrease our quotas this year by 20% from last year's quota. And this is because the biomass has just hit a real low. So I think if you compare us to the rest of the world, we're doing okay, but that doesn't mean that our coasts are that healthy. So we do have a lot of threats that are facing our coast, especially recently, you know, there's been a lot of talk about salmon farms and the problems that are associated with salmon farms. You know, we're harvesting a species, the Atlantic salmon, that is not natural to our ecosystem. We're taking it from the East Coast, bringing it over to the West Coast. We have them in pens, and the feces and the old food will sink to the bottom of the pen and just sweep right out again into the surrounding ecosystems, possibly infecting other fish with sea lice. And salmon, of course, are carnivorous. So where do we get those food pellets from? Well, we have to go into the ocean and harvest other types of fish, grind them up, and then feed them to the salmon. So is that really a sustainable solution? These are the types of things that we really have to focus on locally along our coast right now.
Are there additional threats to marine ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest?
So one of the other threats that is currently about to face our coast right now is the threat of an oil spill. And right now, this is really something that we should be paying attention to because they are trying to expand and have another tanker route, super tanker route, that comes from Kitimat, which is a northern coastal community in British Columbia, and coming all the way through this treacherous Douglas Channel and out and down from BC waters over to Asia. And this is a project that's spearheaded by Enbridge. And it's something that I think we're not paying enough attention to right now. I was last year doing some contract work in the Gulf of Mexico, and I arrived in New Orleans the day the oil rig exploded, and I left the day the oil started gushing into the Gulf. And ironically, I was down there to interview fishermen about fishing practices in the Gulf, totally unassociated with this oil explosion. But after a month, you know, I went back to Vancouver and I continued interviewing these fishermen. After a month, it just became impossible because as the severity of the oil spill became apparent, these fishermen were completely caught up in trying to help out with the oil spill. And actually, one of the fishermen that I interviewed ended up shooting and killing himself on his boat. And it was because he was absolutely devastated by what the oil spill did. And I don't think that we know about those things in Canada, and I'm not sure if the West Coast of the States really understands that as well, what we are putting at risk when we do these things. We've already had a couple oil spills. Exxon Valdez spill of 89 in Prince William Sound totally devastated that community, and they're still feeling the repercussions of that today. It is the people who live in these areas who are going to have to pay the price for it. And that happened many years ago, and they're still feeling it. It happened again in 2006 when the Queen of the North hit Gill Island, which is close to Hartley Bay, and oil is still seeping up from that so many years later. So I think that we need to really consider the threat that supertankers, which have a mammoth amount of oil in them, what that's going to be doing when it's navigating through this treacherous channel, the Douglas Channel. I've talked to kayakers who've kayaked the area who have said that even in a small kayak, it's hard to navigate. So you can imagine with a supertanker how much more difficult that would be. So I really think that we need to write in to our Prime Minister in Canada and for you guys, your President, let him know what you're thinking and become more engaged in these issues.
How well are marine ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest being protected?
Well, I would say not well at all. In British Columbia, only about 2% of our coasts are protected. And when you look at what protection means, if you look a little deeper, you find that it really doesn't mean much. So, for instance, when we're talking about rockfish, the top 7 rockfish species that we harvest in Canada on the West Coast are at or below 25% of their historic biomass levels. And as a response, our government has installed 164 rockfish conservation areas. And these are supposed to be sanctuaries for the rockfish. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, I was looking at it the other night, and there is a list of allowed activities that can go on within these rockfish conservation areas. Turns out you can catch any other type of fish within this rockfish conservation area. You can catch any other type of fish that happens to be the prey of rockfish. So if you're fishing out all this prey, what is the rockfish going to eat in the end? And then you look a little bit further and you see, depending on what type of gear you're using, you can actually continue to fish for rockfish. So these are what we'd call paper parks. They're things that the government puts in place to say, oh, look at all the wonderful and progressive things that we're doing. And then once you look a little deeper, you realize that it's all talk and no action. Also, there has been on the West Coast, the Pacific Coastal Integrated Management Area, PENCIMA, which is happening, being a project that's been going on for the last, well, over 5 years. And it's really kind of the first large-scale initiative trying to get all different stakeholders, including First Nations, fisheries scientists, as well as fishermen and coastal people, to get together and talk about these issues and come up with a large management plan. And just a couple weeks ago, our government has pulled out of that initiative for no good reason. And so we're facing some tough times, some challenges. I think that we could do a lot more when it comes to conservation. And likewise in the States, you guys have a wonderful person who is in charge of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. I think she's the first woman who is actually put in charge of NOAA. And she has a PhD from Harvard in marine ecology, and she's a huge marine conservationist. So hopefully we will see great things from Jane Lubchenco, who is now currently the head director. But I do think that we could be doing a lot more.
You've alluded a bit to this, but what do you see as the best steps that have been taken so far toward protection of ocean ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, one of the things that I find probably the most heartening that has happened on our coasts was something that happened last year in 2010, was the introduction of the National Marine Conservation Area of Guayanas. And this is an NMCA, they call it for short, that covers the southern third of Haida Gwaii. And Haida Gwaii is an archipelago of islands located just south of Alaska. And back in the 80s, the Haida First Nations people who are from that area designated the southern third of their island to be protected as a terrestrial park. And then just last year, they've extended that out into the ocean 10 kilometers. And in doing so, they've protected 3,400 square kilometers of ocean. So this is the real first kind of large-scale protection of ocean and terrestrial system at the same time. And I think that this is the type of thing that we are going to have to see more and more of in the future. And as I mentioned before, you know, when we talk about how integrated and interconnected our ocean and terrestrial systems are, the salmon being one such example, we really have to move away from this fragmented approach of designating little pockets of marine protected areas all over the world and instead zoom out and say we need larger marine protected areas and we need to have them integrated with terrestrial ecosystems as well, because obviously things that happen on land will dribble out and affect the ocean. So that was really exciting for me. The other thing that really excited me about that project was it's a joint collaboration between the Haida First Nations people, between Parks Canada and DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada. So we have 3 different players who all have management capacity for this park.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is marine biologist Sarika Kola-Suzuki. Our topic is ocean conservation and the book Beneath Cold Seas, The Underwater Wilderness of the Pacific Northwest. What do you think are the best next steps to take to protect marine ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest?
as I just said, I think that talking about integrated marine protection, larger scale marine conservation areas, coupled with terrestrial plans is going to be key. Getting stakeholders involved, First Nations people, fisheries scientists, and coastal communities, that's going to be absolutely essential. I also think that all of us need to become more engaged and aware of what's happening in our coastal ecosystems and where we live. And I think the idea of shifting baselines, which is a term that was coined by the marine fisheries scientist Daniel Pauly at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, is a really important term for us all to know. And shifting baselines refers to the idea that with every generation goes the passing of knowledge, goes the passing of what once was. So the classic example is when I go out and go fishing and I catch a rockfish, I think a big rockfish is only, you know, less than a foot long. And when my dad or my dad's dad went out, it was much, much bigger. And so for me, what normal is not traditionally what normal used to be. And what happens is a gradual acceptance of a very unnatural state as being normal. And I encourage people to talk to elders, to talk to their parents and their grandparents of what used to be, what were the things that happened around my city or in my home or in my oceans that used to be when you were young, you know? And what you'll find is probably a very different place than what you now know. And another example is I was talking to a man on the Musqueam Reserve in Vancouver named Willard Sparrow, and he's a First Nations person, and he said when he was young, there was a salmon stream that ran right next to his house. And back in the day, hundreds of salmon would return to this stream. When he had his child, there were only 6 salmon returning to spawn. So you can imagine the relationship that this child would have when there were only 6 salmon coming back to his stream, compared to when his father could go out and catch tens of salmon for dinner. And it is so important that we realize what these baselines are and what our pristine and natural states used to be, because otherwise, how are we ever going to make important and meaningful conservation initiatives?
You have been involved in media work to encourage people to help protect the ocean. What do you see as the key challenges in activating people to become involved in ocean protection?
Well, I think it's very difficult because, you know, most of us don't have the privilege of living next to the water or perhaps not being able to swim or dive or definitely not dive to go in and actually experience these ocean ecosystems. And that's why I think it's so important that we have books like Beneath Cold Seas. The images that David Hall brings out of the ocean and in front of us onto a book is just, I think, very helpful because it re-engages us with those marine ecosystems and it re-inspires us. You know, it's interesting that a couple of years ago, there was a national poll done across Canada asking Canadians what they thought of oceans. When they heard the word oceans, what did they think? And interestingly, the words that they used to describe what they thought of when they heard the word oceans were all negative. So words like overfishing or depleted or polluted come to mind. And this is because we know that oceans globally are in trouble. And I think it is important that David Hall reminds us of the beauty and the life that is still in under the waves, because we do need to protect what we still have.
What would you say to individuals who wanted to help protect the ocean? How can they best help?
Well, I have a list of things actually on a blog, the One Ocean blog for CBC. But basically, there's a few things that you can do. There are some key documents that you can read, some papers that really sum up what's happening around the world with global oceans. There are some videos, films, Sharkwater for one, The Cove is another one. The BBC Ocean series is remarkable. And then there are some things that you can do for yourself. When you go to restaurants and you ask for seafood, you know, maybe inquire a little bit about where that fish was caught, what type of gear was used to catch that fish. Kind of just being a bit more aware of the things that you're eating every day and the impact that we can have when we choose, when we go out for dinner, the foods that we're eating that night. And then, of course, I also encourage people to be political and to talk to their mayors or write to their mayors and ask what their platforms are when it comes to conserving oceans. In Vancouver, we have a really green mayor right now, Gregor Robertson, and I think he's fantastic. He has a plan right now to be the world's greenest city by 2020, but I was looking at his plan the other day and I don't see very much on oceans. So I think it's really important to remind our political leaders that we are curious and concerned about what's happening on our coasts and to hold their feet to the fire.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think the message is basically what the book, David Hall's book, Beneath Cold Sea, sums up, which is we have an incredibly fragile and valuable and spectacular ecosystem here on the Pacific Northwest, but we have to make sure that we conserve it. And right now, we're kind of at the cusp. I mean, we have depleted a lot of our resources, but we still have quite an abundance. And I think that it's absolutely essential that we have adequate protection implemented on our coastlines so that we continue to have this richness and diversity for the next few generations and far into the future.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sarika.
Thank you very much.
You have just been listening to marine biologist Sarika Kulasuzuki speak about ocean conservation and the book for which he wrote the introduction, Beneath Cold Seas, The Underwater Wilderness of the Pacific Northwest, authored by photographer David Hall and published in 2011 by Greystone Books and the David Suzuki Foundation and the University of Washington Press. For more information, check on the web at beneathcoldseas.com. Again, that's beneathcoldseas.com. And also, sarikakulasuzuki.com. That's sarikakulasuzuki.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.